and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Today is a special episode of Loud and Clear. We are so pleased that we are joined for the full hour by John Kiriakou. He became famous because he is the only person prosecuted and jailed in connection with the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, torture, not for taking part in it, but for revealing classified information, according to the prosecution, about the program's existence. Kiriakou was a CIA case officer who led a raid that captured Abu Zubaydah, then thought to be the third highest-ranking member of al-Qaeda in March 2002. In 2007, he revealed that Zubaydah had been waterboarded. In January 2013, he was sentenced to 30 months in prison for leaking classified information to a reporter and served just 2 years at a federal prison before being released in February 2015. Welcome, John Kiriakou.
Thank you very much for having me.
Wow, you were the only person sent to prison in connection with the CIA torture program, the enhanced interrogation program, but not for being a torturer, but for revealing this information to the public. I mean, that's so mind-blowing. How did you feel? How do you feel now?
I'm disgusted by it. You know, I keep telling myself that it's water under the bridge, I need to move on, and I've worked hard to move on, but I'm still disgusted by the entire episode. You know, I was the only one that went to prison. The torturers themselves didn't go to prison. The attorneys who used specious legal arguments to justify the torture didn't go to prison. The CIA leaders who conceived of the torture program didn't go to prison. Even the officer who destroyed evidence of the torture didn't go to prison. I was the only one who went to prison, and I was the one who refused to torture and then went public with the fact that the CIA was torturing its prisoners.
I mean, Dick Cheney's making lots of money. He's selling books. He's making speeches that he gets paid tens of thousands of dollars for. So does Bush. They're defending torture because they say it saved American lives. You exposed that they were lying and you went to jail. When did you go to prison? Where did you go?
I went to prison. I left for prison February 28th, 2013. And I went to the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania, in the mountains of central Pennsylvania. And a little more than 23 months later, on February 3rd, 2015, I came home. And let me add something about that, too. In my sentencing hearing in late 2012, my attorneys asked the judge if she would send me to a minimum security work camp. A work camp is attached to a prison, but it's outside the prison walls, and the inmates at the work camp sometimes work in town. You can work at the local university. For example, you mow the lawn outside. You take care of everything outside the prison walls. The prosecutors agreed to that request, and the judge ordered that I spend my 2 years in a minimum security camp. But when I got to prison and checked in, the prison guard began to take me around to the back of the prison. And I said, no, wait a minute, there's a mistake. I'm supposed to be at the camp across the street. And he said, not according to my paperwork, you're not. And they took me into the actual prison. So I told myself, take it easy, there's nothing you can do, just wait until you have telephone access. 5 days later, I got telephone access, and I called my attorneys. I said, what do I do? They put me in the actual prison. And my attorney said, well, we could file a motion to move you to the camp, but we're not going to get a hearing for 2 years. By the time we get a hearing, you'll be home. You're just going to have to tough it out. And so, to add insult to injury, I spent my entire 23-month sentence with child molesters, rapists, the worst of the drug dealers, violent criminals of every shade. That was one last swipe that the Justice Department could take against me.
Well, let's just talk about that, because this is not the Bush administration's Justice Department. This is the Obama administration's Justice Department. I mean, Obama said that, quote, we tortured some folks, trivializing it, I thought, but admitting it at the same time, something that Bush and Cheney refused to use the word torture for enhanced interrogation techniques. But it was Obama. It was the Democrats. It was those who were elected by liberals in large part, not exclusively, who prosecuted you. Why?
Yeah, you know, in fact, the day after my revelation on ABC News in December of 2007 that the CIA was torturing prisoners, the Bush administration began investigating me. And at the very end of the Bush administration, the Justice Department determined that I had not committed a crime, and they dropped the investigation. It was 3 months later, after Barack Obama was sworn in, that the CIA asked the Obama administration, the Obama Justice Department, to reopen the case. And that's exactly what happened. I still have friends who are involved, of course, in national security. I have some friends who actually still work at the White House. And they've told me that this president's obsession with leaks is unparalleled in modern American history. He's tried to prove himself tough on intelligence issues since he was first sworn in. He does not tolerate leaks unless he or his people leak for an official purpose, that is to make themselves look good, to make the administration look good. Otherwise, he's positively Nixonian in his focus on leaks.
Well, let's compare your case to other high-profile cases of people who are charged with being, quote, leakers of classified information, like David Petraeus, who was the head of the CIA. What happened to him? Compare
that.
Well,
the Washington Post had a really good article on today's front page. Today is Tuesday, the 26th of January. David Petraeus did exactly, and I mean he did exactly, the same thing that I did. I confirmed the name of a former colleague at the CIA to a reporter. The reporter never made the name public, and I went to prison for 23 months. David Petraeus leaked the name of 10 CIA undercover operatives to his girlfriend, who was a credentialed member of the press. She didn't make the names public either, but he got a misdemeanor count of misuse of classified information. This was a misdemeanor. I was found guilty of a felony. And he got 18 months of unsupervised probation compared to my 3 years of supervised probation. So, you know, I said on Twitter the other day, it must be nice to be a friend of the president's. It must be nice to have 4 shiny stars on your shoulder, because you can get away with a lot of things that way.
Let's go back to the original case where you... Well, let's go back to the arrest first, your own role in it, of Abu Zubaydah. Mm-hmm. What happened? What were you doing there? It was in Pakistan. It was shortly after 9/11. Talk about that, and then talk about what happened to him.
Yeah. In the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks, I was sent to Pakistan as the chief of counterterrorism operations there for the CIA. And we got word in February of 2002 that Abu Zubaydah was somewhere in Pakistan and that we had to catch him. So we launched a real manhunt, and it took us about a month. But we did locate him. We had narrowed it down to 14 possible locations, mostly in Faisalabad, Pakistan. And we raided all 14 sites simultaneously on the evening of March 22nd, 2002. Sure enough, Abu Zubaydah was in one of the houses, and he tried to escape. He was shot by a Pakistani policeman with an AK-47. He was shot in the thigh, the groin, and the stomach, very gravely wounded. But doctors there saved his life, and he was finally put on a private jet and sent to a secret CIA prison in a third country. He was allowed about 6 weeks to recover from his gunshot wounds. And then finally, the FBI began interviewing him, interrogating him. Now, the FBI, they're really the experts in this kind of thing. And what they do, the FBI agent who was doing this is named Ali Soufan, an ethnic Arab. Ali Soufan established a rapport with Abu Zubaydah. He was able to engage him in conversation. And Abu Zubaydah actually began cooperating and began offering up to Ali Sufyan actionable intelligence, such as the fact that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. For whatever reason, and I don't think anybody's really been able to determine what the reason was, the CIA was unhappy with the progress that the FBI was making at this secret prison. And CIA Director George Tenet went to President Bush and convinced President Bush to withdraw Ali Sufyan and other FBI agents from the secret location and to allow the CIA to take over the interrogation. As soon as that happened, the CIA began torturing Abu Zubaydah using 10 torture techniques that they had come up with months earlier that they were calling enhanced interrogation techniques. We know from the Senate torture report exactly what was done to Abu Zubaydah. It was brutal. Everything from waterboarding to sleep deprivation to a cold cell. He was slapped, he was punched, he was kept in a dog cage, all kinds of terrible things. And they broke him psychologically. But the real shame, beyond the fact that this human being was tortured in violation of both U.S. law and international law, was the fact that Abu Zubaydah simply did not have any information. He did not have any information that resulted in actionable intelligence, that disrupted any future terrorist attacks, or that saved any American lives. So the whole program was for nothing.
And how did the FBI react to the CIA's authorization, decision to an authorization to begin the torture?
Well, to their credit, or to his credit, FBI Director Mueller at the time, when he realized that the CIA was going to begin torturing Abu Zubaydah, immediately ordered the withdrawal of all FBI personnel from the entire country in which the secret prison was located. Mueller made it clear all the way to the president that he thought it was torture, he thought it was illegal, and he didn't want any of his people involved in it.
So Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times. I think that's the number.
Correct.
83 times. I mean, describe what that does to someone.
Well, a person is strapped to a board or to a gurney with his feet slightly elevated. He can't move. He's strapped pretty tightly. And material is placed over his mouth. It could be a rag, burlap, cellophane, anything. I believe they used a rag with Abu Zubaydah. And then water is poured directly on the face. So some water gets into the mouth, it gets down into the lungs, and it instills a feeling of drowning and helplessness. It's extremely painful because the prisoner is writhing, trying to get out of the way of the water, thinking that he's drowning, thinking that the water is getting down into his lungs. And, of course, your muscles tense up, which releases lactic acid, makes it very painful. At the same time, you're vomiting, you're crying. In Abu Zubaydah's case, he did both of those things, and then he fainted repeatedly when they would do this to him.
But why 83 times? I mean, outside of just gross, barbaric cruelty,
right.
I mean, how can anyone expect, how can an interrogator expect, okay, maybe on the 79th waterboarding, we're going to really learn something new.
Right.
And this is now, I don't know how much, I mean, the waterboarding started in August. That's like 9 months or so, right? Later, after he's already been captured. Like,
right.
What kind of intelligence could they be looking for? I want to ask you this, because I had wondered, and I was discussing this with colleagues at the time, the torture of Zubaydah began at the same time that the Bush administration was now seeking a rationale for the future invasion of Iraq, which took place in March 2003, about 9-10 months later.
Right.
Were they trying to get Zubaydah, not to give them actionable intelligence, but actually to admit to something like, for instance, Saddam Hussein had some connection to al-Qaeda?
You know, I think I'm more cynical than you are. I don't think they even pretended to have a reason to invade Iraq. I think the invasion plans for Iraq began, you know, in the hours after September 11th. I don't think they needed somebody like Abu Zubaydah to say that there was a connection. I think that the Bush administration, and in particular Dick Cheney, and some of the advisors around him, like Richard Perle, for example, I think that they knew that they could pull the wool over the American people's eyes, even without somebody like Abu Zubaydah saying that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq. There was no connection. I mean, they sort of pretended that there was for a little while with this fake intelligence that Mohammed Atta had visited the Iraqi intelligence service station chief in Prague. That turned out to be just ridiculous and incorrect. But they didn't even pretend that there was a real reason to invade Iraq. Iraq was no threat to the United States.
So the torture then was...
The torture was for the sake of torture. You know, this is another issue, too, and this is a really important question that you've asked. You hear a lot of conservatives, especially national defense or national security conservatives, talking about something called the ticking time bomb scenario, where you capture a terrorist, the terrorist has information on a ticking time bomb, you have to get the information before the bomb goes off. Well, in real life, that just never happens. And then so many people in the national security infrastructure use that stupid scenario to justify the use of the torture techniques. In fact, Abu Zubaydah was tortured over the course of months and gave up so much information, 99% of which was just false, that you then have to devote months of analytic time to pour through all this useless information to figure out what's good and what's not good. Well, by then, your bomb has gone off. So this whole idea that you have to use these harsh techniques on people in order to stop that ticking time bomb is just false. It never happens in real life.
You were responsible for one of the people responsible for the capture of Zubaydah in 2001
mm-hmm.
in Pakistan. We're going to go to a break in about 45 seconds, but did you get to know him and what were your impressions?
Yeah, I sat with him for 56 hours after his capture. He was unconscious for the first, 18 or 20 hours. And once he came to, we actually talked a lot. We talked about the September 11th attacks. We talked about poetry. He cried a lot. He said he would never know the touch of a woman. He would never know the joy of fatherhood. He recited poetry. We talked about Islam versus Christianity. I'm an Orthodox Christian.
What did he say about September 11th?
That he did not want to attack the United States on September 11th. He wanted to attack Israel, and that he had been overruled, that this was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's operation. Mohammed was working directly with bin Laden, and bin Laden was determined to attack the United States.
We're going to have to take a short break. We're talking to John Kiriakou, the only person put in prison for the torture program of the Bush administration, not because he tortured, but because he revealed it. But we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Today is a special episode of Loud and Clear. We are pleased that we are joined for the full hour by John Kiriakou, the only person prosecuted and jailed in connection with the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, not for taking part in it, but for revealing the program's existence. John Kiriakou, we were just talking about your role in Pakistan in 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. How did you get there? And then when did you start with the CIA? And you were in Iraq assigned to Iraq for a long time by the CIA. I'd like to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I joined the CIA in January of 1990, having just come out of graduate school. And I spent the first 7.5 years of my career as an analyst. I'm a Middle East expert, and I spent all of those years working on Iraq, including 2 years overseas in the Persian Gulf. And then I switched to operations halfway through my career and spent the second 7.5 years working in counterterrorism operations. Interestingly enough, first working against communist groups in Greece, Revolutionary Organization 17 November and Popular Revolutionary Struggle, two groups that had attacked U.S. interests and U.S. personnel over the years. It was only after the September 11th attacks that I went back onto Muslim issues, and I was at headquarters on September 11th. Like everybody else in the building, I volunteered repeatedly to go to Afghanistan. And instead, they sent me to Pakistan as the chief of counterterrorism operations. When I got back from Pakistan, I worked briefly in something called Alec Station, which was the Osama bin Laden unit. That was only for about 6 weeks. And then I went up to the executive floor of the CIA, the seventh floor, and took a job as the executive assistant to the associate deputy director for operations, who was in charge of CIA's planning to support the Iraq war.
So you were an analyst focused on Iraq during the 1990s.
Yes.
And that started in January 1990. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so that was the beginning of the first, what's known as the first Gulf War.
Yeah, the first Gulf War began with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August the 2nd of that year.
Yeah, so the United States during the 80s had done a lot of collaboration with the Iraqi government during the Iran-Iraq War. Of course, it also partly collaborated with Iran, as we know, with the Contra arms deals with the Iranian government. But the United States really did have a strategic relationship, or a tactical relationship with the Saddam Hussein government in the 1980s, and that was even when the Iraqi government had been shown to use chemical weapons first against Iranian troops in 1983, I believe. Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld was the Middle East envoy of Ronald Reagan. He was there hugging Saddam Hussein the day after the report that chemical weapons had been used against Iran. Explain what the CIA's relationship was with the Iraqi government and then how it changed and why it changed from your point of view.
Well, it was before my time, so I really didn't have direct knowledge. But I know from information that has been declassified that the CIA provided overhead photography, imagery, satellite photography to Iraq of the region along the border down the Al-Faw Peninsula to allow them to better fight the Iranians. And then it turned out, we learned this from the Iran-Contra affair, we were giving the same imagery to the Iranians to allow them to continue fighting the Iraqis. It was a very, very cynical relationship, a very cynical operation from the very beginning.
I was working at that time to stop the war in Iraq, the first Gulf War. I went with Muhammad Ali, the boxer, to Iraq in November, December 1989, right before the war started. We had, as a matter of fact, Saddam Hussein released hostages to our care, 15 Americans, as a goodwill gesture. We were making the point that there could have easily been a negotiated settlement over the Kuwait crisis, but that the U.S. government actually wanted to go to war against Iraq for perhaps other reasons. What do you think about that?
I would disagree. I remember those days like it was yesterday because I was a brand new analyst and I was very impressionable. And I think what it came down to was a colossal misunderstanding. Our ambassador to Iraq at the time, Ambassador April Glaspie, was in Baghdad, and the Iraqis had been making these rumblings about moving troops and armored divisions down to the border with Kuwait because the Kuwaitis were slant drilling in the Rumaila oil field, and they were stealing Iraqi oil. They had been doing this for years, and everybody involved in the petroleum industry knew that the Kuwaitis were probably stealing this oil. So the Iraqis threatened them and said, stop doing this. You're stealing our national wealth. It's an act of war. Well, at first the Kuwaitis denied it, and then they admitted it and said it was a mistake, and they're very sorry, and they'll pay for it. And frankly, we all expected the Iraqis to cross the border, and we expected them to take the oil field. And Ambassador Glaspie went to see Saddam Hussein in July of 1990, and she said something that turned out to be catastrophic, and it was because it was misunderstood. She told Saddam Hussein in that meeting that the United States does not take a position in Arab-Arab border disputes. Saddam saw that as the green light to cross the border and to take Kuwait. So he did. He crossed the border. Now, he didn't just take the Rumaila oil field. He took the whole of Kuwait. He didn't even stop at the northern outskirts of Kuwait City. He took the whole country. The United States then engaged in something called burden sharing. And that is where envoys go all around the region and say, we're going to liberate Kuwait, but you're going to have to pay for it. We can't allow the American taxpayer to incur any of the costs of this liberation. And that's what happened. You know, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the Emirates, Oman, these are the countries that paid for that war. They paid cash on the barrelhead for that war. And it turned out to be a real boost for the American economy. So I can easily see how people conclude that the United States encouraged that invasion in order to sell weapons. I'm not that cynical because I remember the chain of events. I was reading the cables as they were coming in.
I didn't really mean that the U.S. necessarily deliberately provoked the Iraqi invasion. I agree with you about all of the slant drilling and the possibility of a misunderstanding. But my point was that right after Saddam went in, right after the Iraqis went into Kuwait, there was going to be an Arab summit. Right. It was going to be held with Saudi Arabia. There was a lot of talk and a lot of expectation that there would be some sort of reconfiguration and a negotiated settlement. I think, and I actually know that that's what the Iraqis expected.
Remember, it was Yasser Arafat who had originally proposed the idea.
Right. And then the United States had this massive troop buildup and then a war. I mean, 26 countries or whatever number bombing the hell out of Iraq and yep. just destroying the whole infrastructure. And then even afterwards, maintaining just draconian economic sanctions, so brutal that the UN human rights coordinators kept resigning because they couldn't stand the program. Right. And according to the UN, 8,000 Iraqis per month were dying eventually because of inadequate water or lack of medicine or other sanctions-related problems. It just seems to me that the United States has really been at war against Iraq for 25 years now. But it changed with the Bush administration. It changed after 2001 because Clinton, while he was bombing Iraq almost every day, starting with Operation Desert Fox in 1998, they weren't about to invade Iraq. So
right.
what do you account for this shift? Was it the neoconservative takeover? Was it some fantasy?
I believe that's exactly what it was. It was the neoconservative takeover of foreign policy in Washington. I always maintained that the invasion of Iraq was a result of George W. Bush's decision to take vengeance against Saddam Hussein for the attempt to assassinate his father in Kuwait in 1993. It's something that a child might do. And I said a few minutes ago, I'll say it again, the Iraqis were no threat to us. We knew that there was no nuclear program. We knew that there was a very old and meaningless chemical weapons program. Even if they did have a biological weapons program, which I think they never did, they didn't have any delivery infrastructure. So the Iraqis were no threat to the United States. And indeed, because sanctions were so crushing, they really weren't a threat to anybody else in the region either. So I think that this was just a personal dispute that George W. Bush had, where he was going to show how tough he was, and he was going to finish Saddam Hussein for once and for all. And look at the people who were whispering in his ear. You had Don Rumsfeld, who had that personal experience with Saddam. You had Dick Cheney, who was also around in the earlier years, with Saddam, and who had come directly from Halliburton on top of it. You had Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, he's called in Washington, who's one of the leaders of not just the neoconservative movement, but the neoconservative movement vis-a-vis Iraq. And then you had all of these neocon so-called thinkers from the American Enterprise Institute, people like David Addington and Scooter Libby and Dov Zakheim and all of these other people who ended up, you know, finding themselves in senior positions at the Pentagon. It was like a perfect storm for a war that no other president really had the heart to fight.
Let's go back to your own story, because it's not just fascinating for you, it's just such a travail, but it is fascinating that something like this could actually have happened. Walk us through about how you actually went on the ABC News, You reported that there was torture. I think you did more than one interview. I think you were working with ABC. Just walk us through, how did it come to be that you became the target for being the whistleblower who blew the story about American torture?
Well, I had received a phone call in early December 2007 from Brian Ross of ABC News. I had never met Brian Ross before. And he said that he had a source who had told him that I had tortured Abu Zubaydah. I said that was absolutely untrue, that I had never tortured Abu Zubaydah or any other prisoner. I had never laid a hand on Abu Zubaydah or any other prisoner. And indeed, I was the only person who was kind to Abu Zubaydah. And he used an old reporter's trick and said, well, you're welcome to come on the show and defend yourself. So I said I'd think about it. In the meantime, that same week, there was a presidential press conference. And in response to a question, President Bush looked directly into the camera and he said, we do not torture. There is no torture in our country. I knew that was a lie. And then a few days later, in response to another reporter's question, the president said that if there is torture, it's the result of a rogue CIA officer. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to blame this on me. They're going to try to pin this on me. And so I called Brian Ross and I said, I'll come on your show. And I decided that whatever he asked me, I was going to tell the truth. And so in that interview, I said three things that utterly changed the course of my life. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. And I said that the policy had been approved personally by the President of the United States. And so the very next day, the Justice Department initiated its criminal investigation of me. Like I said a few minutes ago, they determined a year plus later that I had not committed a crime. Now, I hadn't been working with ABC at that point. I started working for ABC about 6 months later. What I did is I called Brian Ross and I said, you ruined my life with that interview. The least you can do is hire me on as a consultant. And that's what he did. He hired me on as a consultant. So I sort of became the go-to guy for reporters wanting to do stories on torture. And I had lunch with a reporter from the New York Times, Scott Shane, who asked me about the torture program and asked me about an analyst who was not undercover and who had been interrogating Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, Scott Shane came to me with the analyst's name, and I said, yeah, I know the guy. I don't know whatever happened to him, but I have a business card. And so I gave him a business card. Now, this business card for this CIA officer was unclassified because the officer had resigned from the CIA and had gone to work for a private consulting firm. So I gave Scott Shane the business card. And I also gave an ABC News reporter the same business card. So for the two business cards and the conversation with Scott Shane, I was charged with three counts of espionage, which just, I mean, even now, all these years later, I look back at it and I shake my head, because having lunch with the New York Times and talking about torture is not espionage. Giving an unclassified business card to somebody is not espionage.
You eventually pled guilty to a lesser charge.
I did. I hadn't committed espionage, and the government agreed to drop those charges. So what I took a plea to was violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1981 for confirming the name of a former colleague. As I said, it's the same thing that General Petraeus did, but he was charged only with a misdemeanor.
I mean, let's talk about the Obama administration's crackdown on whistleblowers. You're charged with espionage. That's based on the Espionage Act of 1917.
Yes.
Talk about the act and talk about its application since 1917. 1917, of course, there was a tumultuous period in world history. The
yes.
World War I was on or about to come to an end. There was the Russian Revolution. There was all sorts of fears and hysterias. But talk about the act and then talk about its application and then its application today under Obama.
Right. So the Espionage Act was indeed written in 1917, and it was written specifically to combat German saboteurs in the final years of the First World War. Between 1917 and 2009, the Espionage Act was used three times to prosecute people who had leaked what's called national defense information to the press. The Act doesn't even mention classified information because the classification system hadn't been invented in 1917. And in fact, the law has never been updated in now 99 years. So between 1917 and 2009, three people. Since Barack Obama was elected, he's charged 10 more people under the Espionage Act for leaking information to the press. None of the 10 people charged has been accused of working for a foreign country, a foreign government, or for passing information for personal gain. So this is an irrational crackdown on people talking to the press and telling the press information that the White House either disagrees with or finds to be inconvenient.
John Kiriakou, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. Today is a special episode of Loud and Clear. We are pleased that we are joined for the full hour by John Kiriakou, the only person prosecuted and imprisoned in connection with the CIA's torture program. Again, not for taking part in it, but for revealing its existence. John, let me ask you about international law, U.S. law, and what it means when it comes to torture. Torture is not legal. It's not legal internationally. It's not legal here. You can call it something else, enforced and enhanced interrogation techniques, but it's torture, obviously. If it's illegal and you're exposing the illegality to the public, isn't that something that should be rewarded instead of punished? I mean, doesn't that just make sense to the broad population? And shouldn't it make sense to the Justice Department?
You would think, because it makes perfect sense to me. Is it a crime to out somebody who is committing a crime? I would think not. Now, you've made some very important points here that I'd like to comment on. First, you're right. Torture is illegal. We have a law in this country called the Federal Torture Act. It makes torture illegal, and it defines torture. And believe me, everything that we did to Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and dozens of other prisoners is illegal or was illegal under the Federal Torture Act. Besides the Federal Torture Act, the U.S. is a signatory to the United Nations Convention Against Torture. In fact, we were the authors of the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which also defines torture. So if we've got these laws on the books, how is it that a mid-level attorney in the Justice Department can decide that these laws don't apply to Al-Qaeda? That's really a mystery of American politics. And let me say something else on this issue, too, that I think is very important. In January of 1968, the Washington Post ran a front-page photograph of an American soldier waterboarding a North Vietnamese prisoner. As soon as that picture was published, then-Defense Secretary Robert McNamara ordered an investigation. The soldier was arrested, he was court-martialed, and he was imprisoned for committing torture. Well, the law didn't change between 1968 and the present. So why was torture illegal in 1968, but then all of a sudden it's not illegal in 2002 or even in 2015, and then we need something like the McCain-Feinstein Amendment to formally ban torture again? We have these laws that ban torture, but it just shows you where American politics have gone since September 11th.
You mentioned lawyers writing new memos, new interpretations of the law to make torture legal. In other words, just by calling it something else. Who are they?
Well, it was John Yoo and Jay Bybee. They were the two primary authors of what are now called the torture memos. And interestingly enough, what has happened to those two gentlemen? One has become a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley Law School, and the other has become a federal circuit court judge at the appellate level. So God knows that advocating torture and rationalizing and justifying torture certainly didn't hurt their careers.
Who are James Mitchell and John Bruce Jessen, and what role did they play?
Mitchell and Jessen were two psychologists and CIA contractors who created the CIA's torture program by reverse engineering a program in military training called SEER. SEER is a training program whereby American flyers or soldiers are subjected to different forms of torture, with the idea being if they're captured, this is what they should expect, and it tries to teach them how to withstand these techniques. So what they did, basically, was just take those same techniques, take them to the CIA, and say, here's a program that you can use to get information out of Al-Qaeda terrorists, and by the way, you now owe us $82 million, which is exactly what happened.
George Tenet, who was the CIA director at the time, has spent a great deal of time defending himself. I believe he wrote a book about it. What's Tenet's legacy?
Oh, see, this is Tenet's legacy. I actually know George pretty well. You can imagine I'm not one of his favorite people, but we're both Greek Orthodox origin. We went to the same church. We associated with some of the same people. George and I never really liked each other very much. I was always of the opinion that that George had been sucked into the Bush administration and had fallen under the spell of the neocons in Washington. But this is George's legacy. This is torture is George's legacy. You know, I've said this in public in the past too. When George's obituary is written, it's going to say, yeah, he had all these important jobs. He was at the National Security Council. He was the staff director at the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was the deputy director of the CIA. Then he was the director of the CIA. But he's best known for bringing a torture program into our government again. You know? And what he's doing, going out and giving interviews, writing books, writing a rebuttal, that's to convince the American people that he was right. If he, and this is what I think he believes, if he keeps repeating the lie over and over and over again that torture worked, that eventually people will be either too stupid or too lazy to do the research themselves, and they're going to believe it. And so it's up to people like us to repeat our own mantras, that torture did not work, that torture was illegal, and that torture should never be used again.
The National Commission on Terrorist Attacks, the 9/11 Commission, was deprived of the ability to talk to those individuals who were, in fact, detained and charged with or held as the mastermind or accomplices of the 9/11 attacks. Why was that?
You know, that's the long arm of the CIA. The CIA, frankly, was afraid of what these prisoners would say.
About torture? Regarding torture?
Regarding torture, yeah. I mean, even Guantanamo prisoners who have written memoirs have found that their memoirs are completely redacted. They're completely blacked out. There was one Guantanamo prisoner from Algeria who wrote a memoir, and even his dreams that he recounted in the book were redacted. You know, the idea is not to allow these prisoners access to anybody ever again. They're going to die without access. They're going to die without ever seeing their day in court, without ever facing their accusers, or in many cases, without ever being charged with a crime.
And what about Zubaydah, the man you captured in Pakistan? Where is he? What happened to him? And was he, as was said at the time, the third highest level person in Al-Qaeda?
He is at Guantanamo, where he has been now for many years. He's been in U.S. custody for almost 16 years. He was not the number three in Al-Qaeda. In fact, he never joined Al-Qaeda. He was certainly a bad guy. You know, I'm not going to reinterpret history. He was really a logistician on behalf of Al-Qaeda. If you needed a false passport, he was your guy. If you needed a safe house, if you needed credit cards, if you needed a ticket back to your home country, he's the guy that you went to. He oversaw many of the Al-Qaeda fighters going into the training camps, but he never actually joined Al-Qaeda, and he was never Al-Qaeda's number three.
He was Palestinian.
He was Palestinian, correct. He was born and raised in Saudi Arabia from a very well-to-do, very successful and highly educated father, and a mother who really stressed education for her children. Has something like, I forget what it is now, 8 or 9 brothers and sisters, one of whom lives in Portland, Oregon, and really a very highly respected family.
Let me ask you about the issue of Edward Snowden. You wrote an open letter to, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, to Edward Snowden following his revelations, warning him not to be tricked by FBI officials. Of course, the NSA, the government, demonizes Snowden. You're on obviously on the other side. Explain what you think Snowden's contributions are.
I think Ed Snowden has provided us with a great national service. We had no idea that our government was spying on us until Ed Snowden told us that it was. And that's a violation of the law. Not only the law, but it's a violation of NSA's charter, where it says that NSA may not collect information on American citizens or what are called U.S. persons, that is, those people who are in the United States on a green card. So we really didn't know not only the extent to which the government was spying on us, but that they were doing so at all. So I think he really provided a great national service. I call him a whistleblower in the very purest and truest sense of the word.
Philip Agee was a very well-known CIA operative who dropped out and revealed the CIA's work both in Greece, in Latin America, particularly in Latin America, where he was a station chief. He was not prosecuted, I don't believe. He moved to Europe,
no.
I think, for safety's sake. He's passed away now.
Right.
But Agee was making the argument that the CIA was, in fact, a catalyst for revolutionary movements because it was such a violator of human rights and political rights, the targeting of progressive or left-wing organizations throughout Latin America, its role in Iran and the coup in 1953 that brought down the democratically elected government of Prime Minister Mohamed Mossadegh Day, bringing the Shah to the throne for the next 26 years until the Iranian Revolution. He was exposing the fact that the CIA, in the name of anti-communism or fighting the Soviet Union or as part of the Cold War, was in fact just a violator of human and political rights, and that it largely backfired because while it succeeded in carrying out coup d'etats or assassinations or political repression, it created a very strong image throughout the world that the United States was in fact a violator of human rights. What do you think about that thesis?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Now, I disagree with what Philip Agee did in that he revealed the names of so many of his former colleagues and placed many of them in danger. There have been reports that his revelations even led to the death of the CIA station chief in Athens, although he successfully defended a suit against Barbara Bush, it was, for making that accusation. But anyway, I think Agee's theory was correct, that the CIA was overthrowing legitimate governments, the CIA was blocking progressive forces around the world, and although, as you point out, they could claim successes in some of those operations, such as Iran, look at the fallout from these operations. I mean, here we are generations later, and things are still worse than they probably ever would have been had the CIA just stayed out. And it's not just in places like Iran. Look what the CIA's involvement in Latin America has done to Guatemala or El Salvador, Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic. I mean, we can name countries all over the world. We haven't even talked about Africa or Southeast Asia. Really, the CIA has done far more harm than good, in my view, over the years.
You didn't think that when you started, though. So was it your own transformation in the last few years that led you to these political conclusions, or how did you evolve politically in terms of your own assessment?
I've always considered myself to be progressive all my life, really from my childhood, and I got that from my parents. But at the same time, you know, liberals are patriots too, and I was idealistic and young, and I wanted to serve my country and pay my country back for the great things that it had done for my family and me. And so I was very proud and very happy to join the CIA. Now, of course, I had serious doubts, especially where it came to human rights over the years. But those doubts were really accelerated after September 11th. After September 11th, the organization just sort of went rogue. And with the support of White House and really a supportive press at the same time, there was just no stopping them.
The CIA was originally formed in 1947 as a continuer of the OSS.
Yep.
It was not supposed to be, and I think was legally prevented from spying on the American people. That seems not to be the case at all, especially in the 21st century.
You know, I don't have direct knowledge, but I would say that if NSA is spying on American citizens, I would guess that the CIA is spying on American citizens as well.
You wrote a book called The Reluctant Spy. I think more than one book. But talk about your main thesis of The Reluctant Spy, why you wrote it.
I wrote The Reluctant Spy for a couple of reasons. I wanted to talk about what life was like behind the scenes at the CIA, especially in light of the September 11th attacks and the invasion of Iraq. There were very clear battle lines on Iraq, which was a surprise to me. There was a camp that was pretty strongly opposed to attacking Iraq, and that camp, ironically, the peace camp, was the CIA, the State Department, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The pro-war faction was the Office of the Vice President, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council. That was complete role reversal to me, and I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to talk about how, as a country, we seem to have lost our way after September 11th. And, you know, listen, I was just as traumatized by those attacks as every other American. I was inside CIA headquarters at the time. I had to abandon my car on the side of the highway and walk home the rest of the way, watching the Pentagon burn the whole time I was walking. So I was traumatized then, too. I wanted revenge on al-Qaeda, too. But we can't forget who we are as Americans. We can't forget that we're supposed to be a civilized country. We profess to be this beacon of human rights, this shining city on a hill. And we threw all that away with this torture program. So I wanted to talk about that as well.
In your stint in prison, 2 years, not the campus across the street, you were in real prison. As someone who had never been in prison before, did you come to any conclusions about the U.S. Penal system?
Yes, and I've written about it extensively. I write a weekly column for a syndication service called otherwords.org, and I'm also a regular contributor to readersupportednews.org. And so I spend a lot of my time writing about prison reform and prison issues. Our prison system is broken in this country. It's violent. It's racist. It does nothing for people with mental health issues, and it overuses solitary confinement as a punitive action. Now, solitary confinement has been deemed to be torture by the United Nations, and it was only yesterday that President Obama, for the very first time, decreed that juveniles can't be kept in solitary confinement. My God, what took him 7 years to come to this conclusion? So I wrote a column just today that hasn't yet been published, saying that, you know, this is a fine start, but it really does nothing to address the use of solitary confinement in state prisons, and it does nothing to address the long-term use of punitive solitary confinement for adults. Now, we know that 85% of people who are in prison suffer from mental illness, some form of mental illness. Most of them are antisocial personality disorder. You put somebody in solitary confinement where he goes, you know, months or in some cases years without any human interaction at all. You can go years without ever seeing another human being. Well, that's going to make somebody crazy. And when they start off already crazy, it just makes matters worse. And then guess what? Most of them have an end date on their sentences, and they go right back out into society again, crazier and more violent than they were when they went in.
I grew up close to Attica, New York, where the Attica Prison Rebellion was in 1971. And the prisoners then said, hey, the prisons are the crime. And a lot of people heard them. John Kiriakou, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on this special episode. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.